Hello and welcome to another episode of Football Memories and Moments. I hope you're all well. This week we're joined by Rupert Fryer. Rupert is a football writer that largely covers South American football, and at the moment he has a brief working with Brazilian football around friendlies, which he'll come on to explain. I wasn't quite sure where we were going to go, what we were going to get with Rupert, because I wanted to talk to him because I knew that the work that he's done in Brazil can only just throw up interesting stories. And the whole reason why we've started this podcast was because we want interesting stories. And to be honest, he kicked off with the killer. I won't give too much away, but it's the first time that we've had Carry On Football Memories and Moments. And then it was great to talk about how the interactions he's had with the Brazilian national team. And then to go on and talk about the passion and the real sort of deep ingrained love he has for South American football, particularly in Argentina. And it was great to finish on that. And again, I won't give too much away, but I think he makes some excellent points about the cultural aspects of about football. Just a little note, the theme music, our intro music, was kindly done for us by Kieran Mann, and all the details are on our Twitter. But Kieran hit Kieran up, he's brilliant. And yeah, really hope you enjoy this chat with Rupik as much as I did. Enjoy.
Okay, so I guess my two sort of abiding memories are probably my first time at La Bombonera to see Boca Juniors in Argentina in 2010. And then a slightly more light-hearted one, probably when a World Cup winning manager once walked in on me in Renewed, which is quite a memory and one I kind of hold dear to my heart. It was quite an interesting and funny occasion.
I have to say that when I first read that, I was like, I'm looking forward to that, but I don't want to express that in a way that makes me sound like I'm really looking forward to it. And obviously, if you name the manager, I think a lot of people will be like, well, again, I want to know about that, but I'm not sure why I'm excited to know about that.
Well, it happened in 2010. It was sort of one of my first gigs, really, and a job I've been at ever since, which is being editor of the Brazil Global Tour website, which is the official website for all Brazil's friendly matches. In 2010, it was Brazil's last final warm-up game, actually, before the World Cup, and we went to Johannesburg. And I picked out this memory because it was probably the best sort of 5 days I've had in my professional life, I think. It was a really fantastic time. We travelled with the team for that trip, so I travelled out from London on the most ridiculous of private jets you could ever imagine. I mean, this thing had couches and living room. It had a shower in there, like a full kitchen. It was terrific. And there was myself, a couple of colleagues, and five players. We had maybe four. We had David Luiz, William, and Oscar, who were all at Chelsea at the time. Oh, and so it was four. And Bernard joined us, who had come from I think he was at Shakhtar by then. I think he'd come over from Ukraine, and then we'd all headed off to Johannesburg. So that flight on the way out was fantastic. We just got to sort of hang out and speak to footballers in a way that few of us get the opportunity to do, I think. A lot of the time, you know, dictaphones are on and people can be a little bit guarded and you're trying to coax things out of players. But it was a nice occasion to just sit down and relax, really, in a social setting with some really high-level footballers and just try and get to know them a little bit, really. But long story short, so I've flown over with a team and it included the head of security too, so I got to know him quite well. And the Brazil Global Tour, we kind of were supposed to be giving fans sort of like a behind-the-scenes look at Brazil's sort of global tour around the world. So we follow them everywhere. So we often travel with the team, like I said, like we did on this occasion, and we're sort of where other journalists aren't. And so a couple of days later, we were in the hotel in Johannesburg, and I had a couple of hours really where the players, I don't think they were training that day, or maybe they were training in the evening, I can't remember. But anyway, so I was just hanging around in the hotel and figured, oh, I'll go up to the gym, have a little workout. So I went up to the gym and one of the security guys was standing on the door and had a brief chat with him, and you know, I went really. So there I was in the gym on my own, completely on my own, and next thing I know, the entire Brazil squad comes in. And it's a very small gym in this hotel too. So I automatically got up and grabbed my towel, thought I better give them the room. But the fitness coach came over and refused and wouldn't let me leave. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, the whole team's here, aren't there? There's only like four machines. Half your guys are on the floor and Matt's doing sit-ups because there's nothing for them to do, so I should probably leave." He said, no, you were here first. You were here first. Please continue." So I gave it another 5 or 10 minutes and then went off and tried to leave again. But the same thing, fitness guy came over and said, "There's no way you've done enough workout for today. You've got to carry on. We're doing at least an hour in here." So I said, "Okay." So I went over to the treadmill and Scolari actually got on the treadmill next to me and completely outran me, by the way. The man must have been way in his 60s by then. And he was considerably fitter than I was. So eventually I left the gym anyway and I went to get changed. I knew the whole team were going to be in there for a little while more. So I continued to, I sort of got undressed and prepared myself to get into the shower. And next thing I know, Luis Felipe Scolari walks in with Carlos Alberto Pereira, and who was his assistant at the time. So I'm standing there in the middle of the room, stark naked. And it was a bit of a shock, really. But I guess, in retrospect, you think these people, they spend a lot of their time around naked humans, around naked people, naked guys. They're in the changing rooms every day, so it's probably no big deal for them. So Felipe walked in, and I spoke to him briefly the day before, and he just maintained complete eye contact with me the whole time. "Tudo bem? How are you?" Like, "Yeah, tudo bom, I'm okay." And off, and just continued through. So, yeah, it's kind of sort of like an anecdote that possibly sounds a little bit grander than it was, but it was certainly an interesting situation to find yourself in.
Yeah, it's a nice way. It's the first time we've gone sort of carry on football memories of moments. You know, all you need is someone in the back arms to shout, oh Sid, and you're in.
Absolutely.
Just to, before we go, I think we get on to your main memory then of what this job is and what your interest in South American football has brought you. How did you get into that?
I guess, so I'd always been into foreign football from a very young age. I grew up in Oxford and my whole family were Oxford supporters and we all went to the stadium. I started going when I was about 7 or so. But by that point, my granddad and my father and my older brother had been going since I was born, really, for a long time. And football was always a big thing in our house. And football was on all the time. And my dad was he's an Oxford United fan, cheeky, but he's also a big, big Manchester United fan. I mean, when my dad's heading for his 70th birthday now, so when he really got into football, Oxford didn't really have a team. We were called Headington United and we played in the lower leagues. And so he began supporting Manchester United. And so they were big. My granddad was Austrian, was born in Vienna from Hungarian parents. And he was an Arsenal fan. So there's always lots and lots of football on in my house. And from quite an early age, it seems like not long after I got into football, I kind of didn't really like English football that much. I kind of wanted something more exotic. And I remember as I grew older, when the Champions League started to become a thing and before that European Cup, every time there's a European game on, I was always the one sort of supporting the foreign teams, really, just because it was a rare chance to see people. And I'd heard about them and I'd read about these players in magazines, but it's not like it is now where, you know, you can just hop on, you hear about a player in the Uruguayan second division, you can hop on YouTube and find the highlights for it. It wasn't like that at all. We didn't see these people. Things like World Cups came around once every 4 years, and they were a great, great opportunity because all of a sudden we could see players that we had heard of or we kind of knew about but had never really seen before. Football wasn't really on TV. I was born in 1982, so football wasn't really, there wasn't a lot of football on television, certainly not a lot of foreign football. So yeah, I kind of gravitated towards foreign football, and I also found English football a little bit too athletic, shall we say, for my liking, from a young age. When I started playing football, it quickly became evident I wasn't an athlete. But after a few years, I was pretty good technically. So that's probably another reason, really. But so yeah, I just preferred foreign football, technique-based football, possession-based football. And so I was always into foreign football. And then I got more and more into South American football, mainly through the Brazilian national team and the Argentinian national team. I was a big fan of the Argentinian national team from a young age, which obviously was not that long after the Falklands Malvinas conflict. So people like my brother and friends were like, "Oh, what are you supporting the Ardis for?" But I just loved them. I loved people like Maradona. And so I kind of got on it. I think that's kind of how my interest began. And then going back, I guess, a decade now, when football streaming came around, all of a sudden I could watch these games. And having grown up without the capability to do that, it was a wondrous time for it. It was incredible. All of a sudden I could watch Argentinian league matches, like pretty much all of them. I mean, it wasn't that long after that Football Para Todos became a thing, where essentially the television contract they had with, I think, TC Sports was basically ripped up, and the government took over football, and they showed every single game, and every game was staggered from Friday to Monday, so you could watch all 10 games in the Argentinian top division, for example. So I just started watching loads and loads of football, and all of a sudden I could see these players, and I had this great opportunity to see people who I'd otherwise previously never had the opportunity to see. And it became a bigger and a bigger interest to me. And then at the time, I guess I was working for, I used to work in rap music actually, so I was working for a hip-hop record label in London. And we had a good run, a few years, it was great fun, and then they went bust, and so I kind of had to figure out something else to do. And while I was looking around for other jobs, probably in the music industry, I started a website with some friends, well, I guess friends, people that I just met on a football forum who shared the same sort of similar interests to me. And so we started a website called southamericanfootball.co.uk, and we started writing about it. And at the time, very, very few people were writing about South American football in English. I mean, you had like Marcelo Moreira, Tim Vickery, of course, Joel Richards, who later became a great friend, doing some really good work. But apart from them, there really wasn't a lot. And so I kind of stumbled into this career a little bit. Like I said, I was one of the few people doing it. And so after about, I don't know, 6 months or so of starting this website, I got offered some paid work. And things just snowballed, really, and I've been doing it ever since.
So, because I'm just looking back at you, the messages that we've kind of exchanged in building up to this, and you've got an interest, you do quite a lot of work with, in terms of the Brazilian national team, but mm-hmm. The fact that you're saying the Bombonera, going to watch Boca, that's obviously not, you know, that's different. So, I want to come on to this, and maybe I might ask you this later in the moment, or we'll talk about this more in the moment actually. But do you think the fact that you've really developed this full, completely devoted love to South American football, has it made you reassess English football in terms of how you love that, and particularly as Oxford?
Not really. I mean, I think one of the reasons, I kind of thought about this a few times before, and I think one of the reasons I sort of gravitated towards foreign football and towards people or players with great, great technical and football talent is that for a long time I wasn't really watching football of a great standard. I mean, Oxford United, we've had some really good players. I miss the sort of Dean Saunders, John Aldridge and Ray Houghton era. That was before my time, really. But after that, we had some pretty good players. I mean, again, it's hardly, you know, Riquelme or Juan Alginio or whatever, but we had players like Dean Windass who really, really did capture my imagination. We had a terrific winger called Joey Beecham who should have had a much, much better career than he did. So we did have a few, but I think that probably also played a major part in how I sort of gravitated towards South American football and this technique-based game, because I just wasn't seeing particularly high standard of football for most of my sort of formative years. As I started watching Oxford United, we were sort of fighting relegation in the old, the second tier of English football, and we were quite a humble club, didn't have a lot of money, didn't have many superstars at all. Like I said, Dean Windass was probably our biggest superstar for most of my time supporting Oxford as a youngster, or at least in the sort of first half decade or so. So I think that's probably a reason.
Fair enough. So we'll move on to your first sort of memory. We'll talk about Scolari and we'll talk about that trip. So after, you know, Scolari and you have shared that precious, special moment that I reckon actually quite a lot of Brazilians, or hopefully a lot of Brazilian people would listen to this and think, you jammy, well, not jammy bastard translates into Portuguese, but what access were you given on that trip? Why was it, as you've explained, the best 5 days of your professional life?
Well, because it was, so the squad was much more relaxed under Filipão, both just in terms of the general environment, in terms of the way that they worked, and obviously, like any manager, like any boss of any company or whatever, they kind of set the emotional tone, don't they? Right, that trickles all the way down. And so right the way down to security people, to kit men to general staff around the national team at the time. Don't get me wrong, they're all very professional people, but they're a very relaxed, open, friendly, sort of quite talkable, you know, affable and social people. And so it was all just a little bit more relaxed in those days. And because it was just one game, so usually on international breaks you're playing double headers, so you play two games within 5 days, whatever. But for this, which I think was March 2014, I want to say, it was just one game. So we were just off Johannesburg, and then we were back. And so the match organisers had hired a jet, which would take the, like I said, four of the players from Europe, from London to Johannesburg. And then on the way back, every single European-based player came back with us. And so it was a time where it was the first time where I properly got to know the players a little bit. Like, I spent a fair bit of time with them, just because the company I was working for was handling the logistics. And so the cheapest way to ferry me around was to ferry me around with, you know, the other transportation they organised for the team. And so we had a bus that we'd go behind the players, which we kind of do as a matter of course now anyway. But it was the first time I'd properly been around any footballers, let alone the Brazilian national team, to that extent, really. So right the way, even coming back after, I mean, Brazil won the game 5-0. It was a great match. Fernandinho was a cracker, if I remember correctly, which was the game that got him into the Brazil squad. But anyway, I digress. And so on the way back, all the coaches and all the staff headed back to Brazil, whereas the, I think, 15, 16 European-based players came on a jet with us. And so I was in a situation all of a sudden where there's essentially no senior figures around, no bosses. Filipão, I mean, most of them were, they always described him as a father to them all. So he was very much a patriarch of the group, and he wasn't around either. And so it was basically just, it was a really eye-opening experience, because it was just sort of 15 young guys who were on the verge of something huge, on the verge of something that most of us can't quantify even. I mean, in terms of their professional lives, no matter what they do, nothing will ever be a greater obstacle in front of them than a World Cup in Brazil, and you're in a Brazilian national team. So they're on the verge of something huge. And it was really eye-opening just to spend time with them, hanging around in the airport lounges and stuff, and just seeing them all in their downtime and seeing how they interacted. And they had such a great, great spirit. I was fairly confident that they would do extremely well in the World Cup. I tipped them as favourites. I thought they were going to win it. Obviously, their technical and tactical deficiencies bared out in the end, in that the famous, what Brazilians now just call, best 7-1. But so yeah, it was a really eye-opening experience, really eye-opening time from that perspective. And I had I did a great interview with David Luiz, where we were just, so I'd met David on the flight going over, and I'd seen him a few times around, and he had said to me on the flight over, if you want to do an interview, let's do it. And then I hadn't been able to pin down the time, and so I remember I ran into him in the stadium, and when everyone was going back on the bus, and he said, oh, have you spoken to Rodrigo yet, the press officer, when are we going to do this interview? I said, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. He said, I'm not sure about time. But he said, if you want to do it, I can just do it. So whenever you want to do it. So he said, oh, are you coming back on the flight? I said, yeah, I'll be on the plane. It's cool, let's do it then. And so we all boarded this flight back, and everyone was relaxed, and there was nice food, and there was a huge party atmosphere on the bus. Because like I said, it's just 15 young guys who are out there, bosses around. So they were just sort of really enjoying each other's company, because they weren't spending a lot of time together either. And they had such great spirit. They were all saying, it's just fantastic to be together again. And it was just a terrific time. I remember they started this impromptu sort of, freestyle music. It's called pagode in Brazil. So they all get out, Dante had his little banjo going and stuff like that. So they all get our instruments and they just kind of riff, really. But it kind of quickly descended into a sort of impromptu sort of rap battle, where I think Marcelo started first, and then Rafinha, who was at Bayern Munich at the time, he got up, and so everyone would be pounding and drumming out the beat, and then they would break, and then someone would kind of quote-unquote rap on top of it, sort of direct and friendly insults at one another. And Rafinha, absolutely, he's a great guy, Rafinha. You can see why he's very popular among the teams he's played with. He's a really sociable guy, really popular, very funny character, and he absolutely wiped the floor of everybody. So it was really, really fun to watch that. And remember, I went to a bathroom at one point, and on the way back, Dani Alves and Neymar was kind of the self-appointed DJs. So I think when I walked back, they were playing Kanye West's Power, and Danny Alves insisted that the English boy have a dance-off with him. So next thing I know, all 15, 16 players are all stopped, locked their eyes on me, and I'm supposed to be having this dance-off with Danny Alves. And obviously, I failed miserably, and Danny Alves was the clear champion. And then,
I mean, obviously, you know, you don't want to upset your welcome. You know that there's a hierarchy in the dressing room, but you know, I'm giving you the chance here and now to say, if you put your heart and soul into it, you'd have beat him, wouldn't you? You'd have beat him.
I don't know. Danny Alves can move. He's got rhythm. My rhythm seemed to have deserted me by then, I'm afraid. But they all found it very enjoyable anyway. They laughed at me an awful lot. And then. Yeah, an hour or so later, just before everyone was sort of getting ready to go to bed, David just come over and said, "Let's go do that interview." So we went off and we sat in this room and we did a nice hour-long interview with him about a bunch of stuff. And then Dante hung around, who's a tremendous, very intelligent man. Actually, Dante speaks like 12 languages or something. He's a terrific guy as well. And so it was really interesting because it was not long after, it's 2014, so Pep was at Bayern at the time. Maybe have been there for a season, I'm not sure. But I just remember having a great, relaxed, friendly, off-the-record chat with Dante, and he was telling me about Pep and how things had changed and stuff. And it was just really eye-opening and, just a really, really memorable experience.
That's brilliant. And just, I mean, what was Luis like? Because he strikes me as though the second spell he had at Chelsea seems to be the real David Luis, the player who knuckled down and played such a huge part in the, I think, in the Mourinho, the last Mourinho title. What is he like as a person? Because he just seems to be, you know, and likewise with Dante, because obviously when I was at the Bundesliga doing social media there, Dante was at Wolfsburg and was doing loads there. What was Luis like as a person? He just strikes me as all right. You know when you say about someone, he's all right him. Is that what he's like?
That's very much the impression I got. Very much the impression I got. Like I said, I would only see him sporadically every couple of two or three months. But he would always come right on over. I'd remember my name, group, how you doing? Give me a pound, give me a little hug or whatever. How's the wife and how's things going? I think my wife was, so around 2014, my wife was pregnant with our first child. And so afterwards, I remember when I saw him again, he'd say, "Oh, how's the kid? You had a boy, didn't you?" So things like that he would remember, which were really nice touches. And I mean, but he's like that with everybody, absolutely everybody. Like I said, I mean, I spent a fair bit of time with the security staff. It's an English company who do the security for Brazil. They're a great company, great bunch of guys, very professional. But them too, David would remember every single one of their names. And wherever the team would turn up, and like myself and the staff and stuff were around, he'd always be the one who'd come over, shake everybody's hand, ask how everybody's doing, he'd know you by name. And so, yeah, my experiences of him are just that he's a really terrific guy. There are a few really that stand out. There are obviously a couple of my hometown club, Oxford United, of whom I'm a big fan. There was the FA Cup fourth round replay, I think it was, 1994 at Elland Road, when we'd thrown away a 2-0 lead at home. So we drew to all, and it's a big disappointment for us. And these were a huge club. They were, what, a club just a few years away from being league champions. Oh, they'd been league champions a few years previously, and they had Gordon Strachan and a bunch of great players. And so we'd thrown away this 2-goal lead at home. So we'd gone to Elland Road in a midweek. And so I was 11, 12 maybe. And we were 2-0 up there, absolutely flying. Chrissy Allen scored a great goal. I think John Byrne, perhaps it was, bundled one in as well. And absolutely flying we were. It was fantastic. It was, after years of supporting such a small club, here we were, this huge Elland Road stadium. I mean, they had TV screens. They had TV screens out as you left the stand. So it was an amazing place for me. It was like the biggest stadium I'd ever been in as a kid. And we were playing this great team, this great club, Leeds United, and we were 2-0 up. And towards the end of the game, a whole bunch of their fans all just left. They all left like, the big giant killing is done. We're finished here. And they all left. And Gordon Strachan smashed one in from about 20 yards. It must have been towards the last minute. And then injury time, I think Chris White, who later went on to play for us, bundled one in from a corner. 2-all. And all their fans obviously heard the little roar that went up around Elland Road. So they all came back and they let them all back in for extra time. And I think it's probably the first and one of the only times I think I've ever cried. I was in like 11, but I think I cried. I couldn't believe it. And so how have we thrown it away again? And now they're going to hammer us now. So off I went to the toilet. And as I came back out of the toilet during extra time, I looked up just to see someone just lob a ball up over the Leeds back line. So I raced up, raced back into the stand just to see a ball drop in front of Jimmy Jilton, who lobbed this, who sent this beautiful volley over the top of the goalkeeper. 3-2, leapt into the air, leapt down about four rows of seats. I was almost crowd surfing down. And it was just a fantastic moment and the biggest victory of, the biggest footballing victory of my life, I guess, up until that point. The other one, of course, was the playoff final in 2010. We just spent, obviously, we just spent our fourth season in the conference. Horrendous, horrendous time in the conference. First 6 months or so we got down there, we were the last unbeaten team in England. We did terrifically well, and it all went apart. And we had two or three more seasons in that, and it was awful, absolutely awful. Standing in tin sheds, we were outnumbering fans 3-1. We'd go away, and we'd have three sides of the ground, and they'd put all the home fans behind one goal. And so it was just like, what are we doing down here? And then we lost the playoff on penalties to Exeter, and then I think we had a points penalty because of an admin reason, so that cost us a playoff place for the year after that. And then we finally got back to the playoffs, and we played York City in the playoff final, and I just felt absolutely sick to my stomach the entire day. It was awful. I've never felt so anxious and uncomfortable in my life. I think the entire day was awful, right up until the point when little Alfie Potter and Sam Deering raced clear in injury time after Courtney Pitter had been a terrible player for us, put in an awful corner, and we counter-attacked them. We scored, and that was 3-1. At the time when we were really rocking, I was convinced York were going to equalise, because we'd been 2-0 up in that game as well. And I was convinced they were going to equalise and undo us, but we scored the winner, and it's just, I never felt such euphoria. It was incredible. So there's a couple of moments.
Sorry, Rupert, when it comes to Oxford, I guess I'm left with the impression that you're not a glass half full, not a glass half empty person, but more like, look at their glass, they're going to take our glass in the next 5 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I've seen us do it so often before. And I mean, we're all pessimists, I think, football fans, but particularly when you're a fan of a lower league club who rarely does anything apart from the odd promotion and then the inevitable relegation. So yeah, these moments are few and far between. And so they kind of really, really mean a lot to us, I guess. But anyway, moving on, the moment I did settle on was the first time I ever went to La Bombonera, which I think was 2010. It was just after the World Cup. And it was, and I watch football all around the world, and stadiums all over the world. And I'd grown up with this idea that had been drummed into me that English fans were the most passionate in the world and the greatest supporters in the world. And there was no place like English stadiums, which could not be further from the truth. I have seen football all around the world, and most countries have significantly better atmospheres than those I found in England. Not only now, when people complain that it's all seating and stuff has kind of sanitised everything, but even before that, it's just pale in comparison. And the first time I went to La Bombonera was just remarkable. I think Boca were playing Colón, and they were going to win 3-1. But I remember, so I think Boca went ahead, and then Colón equalised, and Martín Palermo scored his second, and they were 2-1 up. And then there was a natural lull in the game on about the hour mark. And all of a sudden, a flare went off in the main popular, like the main terrace behind the goal. And then another one went up, and then another one went up. And then they started singing, Dali, 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 Boca. Singing and singing, and more people started singing, and more flares started going off. And before I knew it, smoke had filled the entire stadium. I could barely see 5 yards in front of me, let alone to the field anymore. The referee brought the game to a stop. The players came over, pleading with the fans to extinguish the flares so we could carry on with the game. We could get in trouble, the game would get called off. It was never going to happen. This type of thing was happening in Argentina all the time. And people were just going insane, and La Bombonera was rocking. It was properly rocking. It was rocking beneath my feet. And in the press box next to me, there was a person I thought I recognised him a couple of seats over, but someone in between us. I didn't know who he was. I think it is probably just the famous Argentine journalist, and that's how I'd recognised him. Anyway, in the interim, for whatever reason, the person in between us had gone. So he was basically the next person over from me, and subsequently would realise his name was Guillermo Bortman, who was Boca Junior's doctor, one of the medical staff. And he leaned over and grabbed my arm, and he said, I've been here for 20 years. And he pulled up his sleeve and he pointed at his arm. And he said, it gives me goosebumps every single time. And it was just remarkable. I had never seen fandom like it. I'd never experienced a stadium like that before. And it's just, yeah, it's just something that will live with me forever, really.
That's incredible. I mean, I'm looking. I've had a brief look at the YouTube and the likes, and I've seen the pictures. It's I think as well from other journalists interested in that level. I'm gonna get Ed's. I'm just gonna tell me off here, I think, but I'm gonna get Ed Mallion's. Is it Mallion or Mallion? It's Mallion, isn't it?
Mallion. Yeah.
There we go. Sorry, Ed. Simon Hughes as well, who's been on this podcast, and Simon's been to Argentina a few times to see games as well, and it's always something where you look at it and you think that's amazing, but it's not going to happen to me. And was that a sensation? Did you know you were always going to do something like this? Was that the target from the very start of doing what you do?
Sorry, what, going to
going to a game there and seeing that firsthand?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, by this point, I've very early on in my journalistic career, but I basically I enrolled at university at the time, so I was back in Oxford going to university, and I had a good 3 months off for the summer, and I was like, the World Cup's over, what am I going to do? Am I going to sit around getting work writing transfer stories all day, or get I was doing a bit of work on a news desk at that point. Do I really want to do that? And I thought, no, I'm just going to tell my then fiance, right, you need to give me 2 months because I'm going off to Argentina. I've never been before. I'm getting more and more work. It's important for my job. I just need to go. She said, fine, off you go. So I just went off for 8 weeks just to discover Argentina, really. I've been very interested in the country then for a few years. I've been doing a little bit of writing around them for some of my university work. And so it's also important for that. There's a couple of things in my subsequent sort of dissertation that I would work on was going to be based on Argentinian football. So it was a valuable time for me to go, really. And like I said, Fútbol Para Todos, which we mentioned earlier, had started by then. And like, I think 16 of the 20 clubs at that point were in Buenos Aires. And so kind of like Capital Federal, like actually right in sort of the heart of the city. And so that combined with Fútbol Para Todos, I mean, I knew I could watch 4 games a weekend. And so I wrote a piece for someone where I think I went to 5 games in one weekend, starting on Friday and finishing on Monday. And It was just fantastic. It was absolutely great, wonderful time going to see that much football. We had Copa Sudamericana, some games I think running at the time, midweek, and Jonathan Wilson, who I think you've had on before, was there, and that's the first time I'd met him. And we were both kind of hanging around. Everybody else, like Joel and a few of our friends, Sam Kelly, who works at ESPN and has a great football podcast called Hand of Pod, which is an English-based podcast on Argentinian football. We've been hanging around with those guys and stuff, but they all lived there. They had work to do and proper jobs and stuff like that. And Jonathan and I were just kind of kicking about for the most part, sort of writing a few articles and stuff. I think he was doing some research. And so we just kind of started hanging out together and going to as many games as we could, and eating dinner as well. Argentinians don't eat dinner till like 11 o'clock. It's madness. Like with their, we'll see 2-3-year-old children in 11 o'clock at night eating dinner. So Jonathan and I would just rock into these great Buenos Aires restaurants at 8 p.m. We'd have the whole place to ourselves, pretty much. it was a great time, and I got to see so much football in so many stadiums. And from La Bombonera, I mean, there are so many other great stadiums too. Racing Club is a fantastic place to see football. Their Popular, their terrace runs sort of goes around. It goes pretty much covers three sides of the stand. Holds like 30,000 people or whatever. And another journalist, Daniel Edwards, who's now at Goal.com, he was a big Racing fan, and so I started going there with him. And it's a remarkable place to be. It's so eye-opening. I remember the first time I went to Racing, behind me there was a man and a woman screaming the most horrendous abuse I had heard. I learned more Spanish swear words in that sort of 90 minutes than I had in years. And it screaming the most awful abuse at the goalkeeper about his mother's genitals and all sorts. And then towards the end of the game, I turned around like, who are these people? And it was like, she couldn't have been a 13-year-old girl, perhaps. She couldn't have been older than 13. And who I assume was her granddad, who must have been heading towards his 70s. And I looked back and they're at it again. Like, I'm not going to say it, but screaming these terrible, terrible words. And the joy on their faces. And I just remember turning around and thinking, like, this is fandom. Like, this is amazing. This is, look at how this has bridged for generations. And they probably shouldn't be here, because Argentinian football by that point is worse now, but it's terrible, terrible, awful. That they're treated like crap, Argentinian fans. The stadiums, most of the stadiums are in disrepair. They suffered this talent donut, like globalisation was killing their football. All the best players are gone. They just had young kids and old blokes. And that's really all they had. Anyone in between was rubbish. It's like, why do these people keep coming? Well, this is why. This is why, because fandom there is just ingrained in them throughout. But I've got lots of Argentinian friends now, and their entire families are socios. They're all season ticket holders. They all go together. It's just a thing. You're born into an Independiente family, or you're born into a Racing family, and they all just go and watch their clubs, which I think doesn't really happen here certainly as much as it used to.
Is there a disconnect now between Argentinian fans and Argentines themselves? And the players that represent the Argentinian national team. Is there a disconnect between them?
Well, I think so, which is kind of inevitable. This isn't specific to Argentina. It happens in Brazil a lot too. So the players leave early, and lots of them leave before even kicking a ball in their home country. Like players like Roberto Firmino, for example. I remember when Firmino first got called up to the Brazilian national team. A bunch of Brazilian journalists were asking me who he was, because they had no idea. You know, like, because he had barely played. I think he had played like 10 games in Brazil before he left. And that happens to a lot of them. And so, yeah, it's inevitable. And you'll see every time there's a squad announcement, we've got the Brazil squad announcement coming up today, is that the players who are either at the biggest clubs in that country or who have represented the biggest clubs in that country before leaving, they always have a greater groundswell of support ahead of each national team, because people, again, we go back to the well documented issues that Lionel Messi had before, with this apparent disconnect between him and local Argentine fans. So he left so young, obviously 12, 13 when he left, and so they were like, he never played for Boca, he never played for River, he never played for Racing, he never played any of the grandes. Like, who is, you know what I mean? Like, is Messi even Argentinian? There was a bit of that at the time. I think it was overblown. I think there's generally been a lot of support for Messi throughout his Argentinian career from most fans who are just delighted that the best player in the world is Argentinian and wants to play for Argentina when he could have played for Spain and is very much Argentinian. But yeah, there absolutely is that. I think it's inevitable with like I said, with globalisation, with the amount of players who are being exported now. I mean, for the fifth, sixth year running at least now, Brazil, I saw a report recently, Brazil were far and away the biggest export of footballers once again.
Going back to the game, the actual game itself, what was the standout moment, apart from, you know, the breakout in a small civil war within the players, but what else in terms of the actual football, what was the standout moment for you?
Well, Martin Palermo had the most Martin Palermo game of his career, really. Like, he scored a hat trick that day. I can't remember the goals, but I'm sure at least one of them was, maybe a couple of them were bundled in from close range. And he missed the penalty too. Of course he did. So I think we were 2-1 up and Boca got a penalty. And Palermo stepped up and smashed it. I think it flew over the bar. And again, the person I referenced previously, Guillermo Bortman, just leaned over and he went, "Don't worry, he always does that. He'll grab another, he'll get another one." And he did. He did, of course he did. So he completed his hat-trick later on, I think bundled one in right on the line or whatever it was. And so, yeah, I think it was 3-1, really routine win. I think that day Colón went a great side. I think they had a good coach, though. Whose name suddenly escapes me, Mohamed, someone. He's called him El Turco. Anyway, so, yeah, I remember being quite interested to see him. He was quite, I think he did a few quite interesting things tactically. I should have digged out my notes from that game, actually, for this chat, but I didn't. But, yeah, it was mostly memorable for that. I mean, A big part of my reason for a big part of my love of Argentinian football had been Juan Ramón Riquelme, who is my all-time idol. My son's middle name is Roman because of Riquelme. I didn't tell my wife that at first when we first decided upon it. She just liked the name. But a lot of it was a pilgrimage. I just wanted to see him. I just was desperate to see him for Boca because obviously he was back there at the time. But he spent the entire time injured. I didn't see him. No, I didn't see him. I subsequently did see him for Boca a few times, but yeah. So I just mostly remember it for being a great night in La Bombonera and a very, very Martin Palermo night.
It's interesting. A couple of things. I was tempted to wrap it up there, but you have brought two things that, one, I don't think I've ever seen Martin Palermo playing longer than 15, 20 minutes in terms of all the highlights and stuff. But he seems to me to be the player that best embodies or epitomises Argentinian football, domestic Argentinian football over the last sort of 15 years. He's always been that player within the domestic league. And secondly, we obviously share your, as an Everton, I'm never shy of getting Everton into this podcast, mm-hmm. but, you know, the day that some goon at Everton's IT department decided to do a web test page with Everton seal Riquelme signing, and the yeah. whole blue half of Liverpool going absolutely mental and then realising that it wasn't quite right. I think the website actually broke because of it. Because when he ran as ragged in the Champions League qualifier in 2005, the whole of Goodison fell in love with Riquelme that day. The whole of Goodison. Yeah. He's easily in the top five players, best players I've ever seen at Goodison.
He's something else. He's remarkable. Like I said, I think I mentioned it previously. Football just became a little bit too athletic for me. I think some of it now, I mean, if you look at, for example, Manchester City and certainly some of the Pep teams and some of the other chilly teams that Bielsa's put together of people who are intensely fit, but play this wonderful possession-based, frantic, attacking, exciting football. I think that's terrific. But I still think there have been way too many hard runners in football who have been, I was going to say stealing a living, that's well unfair, but that's sort of what my dad labels professionals, people who aren't particularly good at football, but they know how to play football. They know how to play football very well. And Riquelme just kind of stood. I mean, it's like, there's a great quote from Eduardo Galeano. It says, "The technocracy of professional sport has managed to impose a football of lightning strength, a lightning speed and brute strength, a football that negates joy, kills fantasy and outlaws daring." And, I mean, it's typically quixotic of Galeano because that's who he is. But something about that just really resonates with me. And I think Riquelme just for so long stood in opposition to that. I mean, when football was becoming more and more so visceral, and Riquelme just stood resolutely cerebral. Like, no, I'm not going to just be fit. I'm not just going to run. I'm not just going to work my ass off. There's something more for us to be pursuing through football. You know, because, I mean, more people play football each weekend around the world than do anything else, I'm sure. Like, football's a leading mode of culture. Like, and I think for lots of us, or maybe not for lots of us, but I think for many of us, I think football, I think we can learn a lot about humanity and about culture and about the world through football. Because the way that people play football in different countries is a social expression. It's a cultural expression. It expresses who we are. I think Riquelme, I think there's a great dichotomy in Argentine football between the 10, Riquelme, and the 5. They're the two most revered positions in all of Argentinian football and have been for many, many, many decades now. And I think it's a great contrast and probably something we haven't really got time to go into in depth. But I find that fascinating that the two greatest, most revered characters in Argentinian football are this great artist and the bloke whose chief job is to stop him. And if you go to any Argentinian game as well, the biggest cheers you'll ever hear are for one, a caño, a nutmeg, and the two, a crunching tackle. They love a crunching tackle. It's the only thing they love possibly as much as a nutmeg.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. It really was a good chat, and I liked what he said about Argentinian football, that their two favourite things are the artist and the butcher, almost. And it's interesting, I think South American football culturally has a lot in common with English football. But yeah, it was good. I really enjoyed it. A couple of technical issues that we sorted out. My thanks to Rupert again for giving up his time, especially on the day that Brazil were announcing the squad. I really do appreciate that. And hope you enjoyed it. Rupert can be found on Twitter at Rupert Fryer, or by searching Rupert Fryer in his name. And have a lovely week, and we'll see you all soon. Bye now.